Welcome to a very special episode of Raven Conversations. I am your guest host, Major Laura Dutton, and this is a special episode for our June Pride Month series. And I'm here once again with special guest host, Major Callie Kionis.
Today we have an incredible guest, and in our conversation, hopefully we will examine the history of anti-LGBTQ legislation and military policy. This individual has a direct link to the history of the Washington Army National Guard, and more importantly, has positively impacted openly serving service members for over three decades. Our guest is a published author, has a master's degree and a PhD from the University of Washington, witnessed firsthand the horrors of combat in the Vietnam War, earned a Bronze Star Medal, and has completed over 30 years of military experience, finally retiring as a full bird colonel. In 1995, her book, Surviving the Silence, was adapted into a TV film of the same name. It was produced by Barbara Streisand and stars names like Glenn Close and a young Ryan Reynolds. This movie garnered critical acclaim, earning praise and recognition through a Peabody Award and three Primetime Emmy nominations. And that just gets us up to 1998. There's a whole another 30 years of experiences and advocacy to talk about, and our guest today is Colonel Greta Kammermeier.
Colonel Kammermeier, do you mind if we still call you Colonel?
Oh, I love it.
Okay, excellent, ma'am. Well, we would love to, having that representation, especially as we're doing this for our younger soldiers to really show we wanted to highlight your connection with the Washington Army National Guard, but also highlight your connection not only during Pride Month and what you've done as a trailblazer for standing up for LGBTQ rights, but also standing up for the military and the service members and having the courage to fight military policy when you thought it needed to be changed. So, Colonel, can you introduce yourself and give us a little bit of your history and tell us about your time with the Washington Guard?
Sure. I'm Colonel Margaret Kammermeier. I go by Greta. I was in the military for 25 years, had a late epiphany and figured out I was a lesbian. And that was at the time incompatible with military service, even though I had been in for 25 years by that time. So I was chief nurse of the Washington State National Guard at the time. So it was awkward, to say the least, to be told that I was going to be discharged because I had said that I was a lesbian in the top secret security clearance I had applied to obtain so that I could apply for the War College. In that, I had mentioned that I was a lesbian, and 6 months later, they came to my commanders and said that they would start discharge proceedings against me based on my statements. The National Guard said that if I wanted to remain on duty, that they would support me as much as they could. And it took 2 years. I mean, that's how dangerous I was. It took 2 years for them to actually have the board hearing that ultimately discharged me. We immediately went into federal court to file suit against my discharge. It took an additional 2 years for me to be reinstated, stating that, I was denied my constitutional rights. So I went back into the Guard in 1994 and was supposed to go back and take the same position I was in at the time of my discharge, but it seemed to me that that was very inappropriate for the unit itself. To go back in to become chief nurse at that time of the hospital, also the 164th, it just did not seem to be the appropriate thing to do. And I asked for some sort of a transfer anywhere, but I think the Guard was very concerned that I would go back into court and there would be more litigation or issues like that, and they said that they were perfectly happy with me as chief nurse. And so I decided not to assume that role, but to act as an assistant to the chief nurse that was there at the time. And then after a year, I went into the inactive reserve, and ultimately, after 31 and a half years, was retired from the Washington State National Guard. And curiously, I had not been notified and didn't know about it until I got a letter from President Clinton thanking me for my service. That was how I found out that I had...
I'm retired.
Yes, that I'm retired. So it was a curious journey.
You had said that it took 2 years to go through the initial board to decide to discharge you. In that time, did you continue to work with the military?
Yes, I was still on reserve status. Nobody was supposed to know. There were maybe a handful of people in the Guard that knew what was going on. As long as it wasn't disruptive, was what the statement was. But you see, I had the state surgeon did not want me to be discharged. And neither did the Guard, and the governor didn't, and legislators didn't, and they had, you know, written letters to the military to not have that happen, but that did not prevail, and so I was discharged. But in the interim, the state surgeon, you know, there were things that came in the way so that I couldn't have my evaluations at Madigan, and I couldn't have this done because there were other things that took precedence. So there was always a reason why administrative board hearing was not scheduled, because the work didn't get done to submit it. And finally, the state surgeon was told that if he didn't start discharge proceedings against me, that they would come after him. Wow. And so with that, it moved along a little ways. As soon as I had been told that I was going to be discharged, I sought legal assistance, and through the Northwest Women's Law Center, through Perkins Coie, through Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, I had then been able to get a legal team that would support me in this journey of fighting the military policy. And so they were working busily, trying to get depositions and all of the things that they needed to have before we went to court, because the way the system works is you have an administrative hearing, a decision is made, and it was made that I should lose my
federal
recognition. And with that, it still went up for appeal, sort of a routine, so that took another year. Then we would file, as soon as my discharge took place, then we would file in federal court to overturn that decision by the military. And it took a long time to get the depositions that my attorneys wanted. So they had talked with the assigned president of the board, Patsy Thompson, that they needed more time to get these depositions. And so by the time it was all dragged out, it was a two-year process. But you think in terms of how realistic is this whole shenanigans to begin with, because they could discharge somebody yesterday rather than prolonging it like this. And so we then had enough time to get the depositions needed, because once you go into federal court, you can't add new information. It has to be a complete packet that the court rules on. And when all was said and done, they ruled that, you know, my discharge was unconstitutional. And this was, you know, with the previous regulation, this was before Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That's the policy that I was discharged, that homosexuality was incompatible with military service.
Outright ban.
But, you know, at the same time, there were historic records that were lost, so that, you know, others were able to serve, but it still was something that was certainly not talked about. And I remember that when I went through basic in 1963, my gosh, the one thing that I remember hearing about homosexuality was that it was incompatible with military service, and I just sort of blew it off because it didn't apply to me. And so I knew that that was there, but really it had not been a part of my military experience at all. And I think, you know, in those days, there was such a separation between healthcare workers and the rest of the military that I, you know, was not aware of people constantly being discharged from the military because of their sexual orientation. And so it seemed to me that they ought to make exception, because I had already been to Vietnam, had my Bronze Star, I was finishing my doctorate, and how dangerous was I? I mean, I could go on and on and on to say it.
Well, one of the things I wanted to talk to you more, particularly about the lens, because your story was uniquely impacted by your service in the Guard. You know, you were active duty, and then you had spent some time in the Army Reserves as well, and then finally came into the Guard. And part of your being in the medical community, which is, you know, a closer community, you guys are specialists, you're generally a little more, like, you know, you work closer together and you stay together longer, and the Guard itself has a closer command relationship where, you know, you can work in the same place for 20 some years. So when you say that you had, you know, your surgeon wanted to keep you in, you know, the TAG wanted to keep you in, the governor wanted to keep you in, you had that local support from the Guard. Do you think you would have had similar if you were in the Army Reserve or the larger active duty force?
Oh, I don't know. I think you make a good statement about that it is a small family, and that the Guard has the unique opportunity to take care of our own, like in Washington State itself, which is what is different from the reserves, that you can't, you know, in case of a flood or a disaster in the state, you know, you call up the Guard, because they are the ones that can do something on a local level. And I think that also means that we are
tied more to the community itself.
Yeah, so the governor actually, you know, was able to be tied into your story and able to support. You were able to get legislators on board to be tied into your story and able to come and support. And I look at our active duty counterparts and wonder, like, for them, if they would have been able to get that kind of support at that level.
Didn't help.
No, yeah, well, that's true. Well, you got pushed back in, but... And then also looking, you know, when you first made the statement, you know, that you were a lesbian, coming in, your history with the military, there had been many times when you'd say, hey, this is a bad policy and I have to stand up against it. You know, whether it was when you were a young officer that's like, I'm not going to leave my patients right now. I need to stay with them. I am going to deny a direct order to leave until someone comes that can take care of them. And you were able to see success with, hey, I stood my ground, I fought for what I thought was right, and regulations and policies were able to change. And going into this, there was almost a sense of naivete of, hey, this is wrong, telling the truth is right, I'm not a threat. The right thing to do is to be honest here. Let's see if we can change the policy. And then, whoa, that did not.
I don't think it was that clear cut.
Okay. Probably not at all.
No, because you're pretty naive still when you go through, regardless of what your rank is, you know, until you've had a particular experience, you don't have a clue as to which direction things are going to go. And so my goal... was to become a general, to go to the War College and be competitive and be able to vie for that position. And that had been my goal since I first joined the military, you know, 25 years before. And so this phase was, okay, well, I have to have a top secret clearance to do that. And, you know, I just went into it naively. And when the question about when immoral conduct or something like that came up, I hesitated a moment and said, you know, I am a lesbian. Now, you know, I don't know what that, how that related to immoral conduct, but it was a statement that I made, after which, you know, my world turned upside down. I continued to be part of being interrogated for another 3 or 4 hours, so that it was a long period of time trying to sort of equate my statement with some sort of conduct, which I, you know, flatly said it had nothing to do with conduct. It had to do with how I self-identified. And at the end of which he said, well, I'm going to need this in writing. And I said, well, you know, I'll get something to you tomorrow or something like that. And he said, well, I know exactly what they're looking for, so why don't I write it? And then you can read it and make whatever changes and then sign it. And so, you know, in 20 minutes, he had written the statement of a 4-hour plus interview, and I scratched through a bunch of stuff and then signed it, and was, you know, then it was done. And so, and so was my career ultimately, and that's what, you know, Diane told me at the time, you know, you're done. And I couldn't believe it. You know, I said, well, you know, I've got this track record. Why would they throw me out for something that is irrelevant? You have to be naive to believe sometimes. So when they came after me, then it was, you know, taking a stand. I could have retired, but chose not to. And I think one of the reasons for doing that was that, having been in the military when women could not be married and join, and the policies ended up changing, that women could not be married with dependents, and that policy changed over time. And so it seemed to me that, you know, for policies to change, you have to have somebody challenge the existing policies, and I thought that I might be able to do that. In my delusion of grandeur, I had played this out a little differently. I had thought, okay, I become a general, I become chief nurse of the National Guard at the Pentagon, and when all is said and done, I go to Congress and I say, and I just happen to be a lesbian, you know, after the fact. But that's not the way it played out. You know, so it was reversed. But, you know, as an aside, you know, the rest of the story is that after I was discharged, I went on a lecture circuit and was at various colleges talking about, you know, gays in the military while we were trying to change what had become Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Mm-hmm. And I was at Davis University in California when a woman came up to me and handed me her business card, and it was Barbara Brass and Patsy Thompson. Patsy Thompson was the woman who was president of my administrative board. I had no idea that she was a lesbian. And she had been a chief nurse of the Washington of the National Guard Nurse Corps at the Pentagon. Wow. And so she came out when she was 85, only a few years ago. And there's a story about her, a documentary called Surviving the Silence, about her relationship with her partner and with me, and which is, you know, one of those And the rest of the story is, but I'm so glad I didn't know that she was a lesbian, that she was put in this really awkward position of having to discharge me and really not having a choice. You know, they couldn't go against Army regulations at the time. And so it was a foregone conclusion that I was going to be discharged and then we were going to go to federal court. And so that's how it happened. But she herself, you know, was very, very helpful for my legal team because she too was dragging her feet in setting up a time for the board hearing to take place. So, you know, it's sort of intermingled, to say the least.
You had mentioned that, like, prior to your experience in 1989, 1991, when the whole investigation started, you were quite vocal about other policies the military had, obviously not being able to be married and be in the military, or be pregnant and be in the military, or on full-time orders in the military. And then, obviously, everything that happened with your court case and fighting for your own career. But there's also a whole story after that where you fight for the repeal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy and have become a very vocal advocate for just women's rights, human rights, and obviously a big advocate for the LGBTQ community. And I'm just wondering where... it seems like there's people who become involved in advocacy by circumstance, which someone could look at your situation and say, oh, hey, like, this one instance is what turned them into a kind of an advocate and a voice for this community. But you kind of have this whole track record spending your life just kind of standing up and speaking your truth and talking about when you feel like things, there's improprieties and things aren't right. And I'm just wondering where, on a personal level, like, that drive comes from.
I think I sort of look at my parents, and I was born and raised during Nazi occupation in Norway. My parents were part of the Norwegian underground. They, you know, were trying to do the best that they could under the circumstances of the Nazi regime there. And we would have people who had been found out by the Nazis, and we would hide them in our apartment until we could get them out of the country through the underground that was there. And I think looking back over, not that I recall those experiences, but, you know, your family sometimes sets the standard. And I think I always look back and say, would I have been as brave? Would I have stood up the same way? Would I have participated? You know, what would I have done under the circumstances? So again, in my delusion of grandeur, it's like when something happened in the military that just didn't seem right. However small or big it was, it wasn't for a greater cause, but it was just for the right thing, that there was the opportunity then to take a stand and do that. And I think that is part of just who I am. If I decide to take a stand on things, I don't on all things. when it came to the military and the previous ban against homosexuals serving in the military, it made no sense. And, you know, although I was, you know, the person's case that was being presented to the public, it was about me in part, but it was also to change the policy in some way. And so the conversation societally ended up with Bill Clinton and the sort of the compromise Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And he got a lot of flack for it because, I mean, that's not... Living in silence And you're still living a lie, mm-hmm. and you're still in fear of losing your career. So, you know, during those 17 years where it was in place, it was 13,000 plus that had been discharged just under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that was supposed to save and prevent discharges from taking place. So nothing had really changed. And for those of us who had participated in the beginnings of the conversations about what compromise could be made, and I testified in Congress, and it was an ugly time, but you also have to put it back into the context of society at the time. You know, homosexuals were identified as pedophiles. They didn't have any relationships. They were trying to recruit kids. It was, Anita Bryant and her Christian, Save the Children, that was sort of defining who we were. And because we were silent, there was no one to dispute how we were identified. Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church, mm-hmm. and them being out at anything that has to do with funerals or yeah. anything else, that they were demonstrating. And so my job, when I lost, it was, what am I going to do then? And so to have an opportunity to speak out and sort of define who we were and try to change the myths that had been surrounding us as individuals. And then you get AIDS in the middle of it all, So every time you have one step forward, you have maybe one and a half back. And so it was continuing to talk. And the more you talk, the more other people say, I have a gay son, or I have a lesbian daughter, or, and it becomes something that you can speak about. So it was, I think, important for me that if somebody was interested, you're interested. Mm-hmm. Why would I not participate to talk about what it's like, what our lives are like? It's like everybody else's. But you have to have somebody talk about it. And I think that's the way things started. And then I get a phone call. I'm a nurse, so I was working at the VA. And I get a call from Barwood Studios. I have no clue as to what Barwood Studios is. Well, I'm calling on behalf of Barbara Streisand. Ah, a name that I recognize. With my attorney, I went down and talked with Barbara and NBC and all of the producers. And she says that, wouldn't you like to have your life story told on television to 50 million people? And I said, no, not particularly. and she said, I consider it the most important social issue of the decade. And, that's when you step out of the way, because what you're trying to do is change the narrative. And you can only do that as the story is told. And so that's where the movie, Serving in Silence, with Glenn Close and others, and Judy Davis, came about. And with that was all of the notoriety. And I think I get credit where it really shouldn't be, because there were thousands of other gay and lesbian soldiers who had fought the policies in the past and who had tried to change the policies but were either ignored or discarded or lost their lawsuits and things like that. And so it has felt as though I still am a nurse. I don't consider myself an activist. But I think that if my presence makes a difference, then I need to be there. And so ended up getting involved in things that were amazing, in part, but also were you know, very stressful because you never knew what, you know, what the ramifications were going to be. But lots of stories along the way.
And in a lot of way, your work and your putting your vulnerability, putting your story out and what you did, you know, you paved the way for the careers like of Callie and myself. You know, I joined in 2003, and in my paperwork, like in my enlistment file, I had don't ask, don't tell paperwork. And it was this long sheet that said, just so you know, the following actions are still non-compatible with, you know, with good conduct. And it, you know, went on to explain. And, you know, it looking at it in retrospect, like it was pretty hard to read. And my personal story, it's a bit different. And in some ways, you know, I could relate a lot with yours. You know, going into when I was in the military, I didn't really have a full understanding of myself or my sexual orientation when I was at that place in my life. I was young. I was underexposed. I was from the Midwest. So I was like, oh, well, this doesn't apply to me. And if it did, I'm certainly not going to question any of it anymore, because obviously, like, that was enough to install a fair amount of like concern and self-hatred. You know, when you start reading, like, these things make you not a soldier when you're working to try to want to be a soldier. So, you know, for the first part of my career, I was, you know, like I said, everyone has their own coming out. Everyone understands that at a different time and a different place. And honestly, the transition for some people is still ongoing. So I love the fact that with younger soldiers and younger people in general, they don't feel as compelled as our generation might have to, like, establish, you know, your identity, and I am this early on or early off. And they kind of feel that they have a little more flexibility and they're a little more free to explore and define themselves. But for my early on, like, having that paperwork and having those thoughts, I mean, you look at how we brought in, like, you can either be a soldier or you cannot. And, you know, that was a lot to, like, look at 20 years later and think, how did this fit in? You know, how did this fit in? And how did we think of ourselves as soldiers? And how did we think of ourselves as people? And then your experience was a bit later.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah, I joined the military at the tail end of the don't ask, don't tell policy. So I think within just over a year of me actually contracting as an officer, it had been repealed. But going through ROTC, it was just kind of an unwritten rule. You didn't really talk about any of those things, which was a weird place for me to be in because I come from a liberal arts background. I was a sculpture major, which, as you know, like talking about political ideas and being vocal in the art community is kind of secondhand, and it's a way you communicate those ideas is through artwork. So to come into an environment where it's just like, hey, like, we all know, but don't say anything, was a little bit eye-opening for me. But then to your point, Laura, it is a little bit interesting to see now the younger generation where they don't feel like they need to talk about their background or their experience or their gender or how they identify, is comforting, but also at the same time, I think it highlights the importance of speaking to people like yourself, because we know how important it is to have that representation out in front of a group of people, because without it, I feel like you lose a little bit of your context and like, why it is important to talk about your experiences.
And we also know that not all battles have been won. You know, we are still, like, we still approach things with a certain amount of the same naivete, where if I just do all the right things and check all the boxes, things will work out. And that's not the case for everybody. You know, there's still fights that there are still people who need activism. There are still people who need their stories to be told. And there's still people who are underrepresented and underserved that need, you know, advocacy for them. And so, you know, your story and your courage and putting yourself and your family and, you know, and your civilian job as a nurse all at risk for being able to say, no, I'm gonna say that this is who I am, and I'm gonna not only say it, but, you know, because given the opportunity to say, hey, was this a mistake? Did you mean it for real? Okay, if you're going to say this, just retire and go away. There are a lot of easier options for you, and you didn't take a single one of them.
And how do you cope with that? Also, because it's not just I made this decision that impacts my family and my career, but it becomes so visible. And
on that, you don't know what you're doing.
Man.
I don't know if you know the case of Dusty Pruitt, who was a minister. She was in the Army Reserves and hadn't meant to come out. She was interviewed in Los Angeles by a newspaper, and she was a minister in the Metropolitan Church. And her unit found out about it, and she was summarily discharged. And so she ended up challenging her discharge also just before I did. And I had a chance to talk with her while we were making decisions about how to move forward with this. And I said, would you do it again? And she said, in a heartbeat. it's like you don't know what you're getting into, but you know that the reason that you're getting into it is the right reason. And then all of the, we had negative things that happened along the way. But, you know, ultimately what happened is that we worked together, and Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. And so the mission was accomplished. And it was a mission, and it was a collective mission. But I want to go back and just catch up a little bit on your comment about in today's military, how they really don't understand what life was like when you couldn't come out. It's a little bit like the abortion. You know, Roe v. Wade was overturned, and people of today are just now finding out the ramifications of what happens when you don't have options about your own life. We've already fought that battle, 50 years ago, and now it's churning up again. And so if you don't pay attention to what's happening today and in today's society, then things are apt to reverse. I mean, there is the risk of having someone else come along and say, you have to ban gays from serving in the military. The typical example has to do with the trans. Mm-hmm. They have, yes, you can serve, no, you can serve, only if you don't have this and you don't have that. It's like one thing after another until there was the full repeal. But it's not in law. And having it not in law means that it is a regulation that can be changed on the whim of a commander-in-chief. And so it's working with the legislature, whether it be on a state level or on a federal level, to such a point that what was believed to be true, that we had precedence and that we had the right to our own bodies, is put into law so that one really does have the right to self-determination with that. And I think that probably is as important as anything else, is not to take advantage of the rights that people have fought for all these years, so that you would be able to serve and to be out and to, it's like, can you imagine today anybody that doesn't know somebody who's gay? I mean, because we are so public and it's so much in the media and, people don't care. And now it's you have to define yourself by your pronoun. For those of us a little older, that gets really complicated, especially when it's a plural. I think trying to remember that we have probably had over 100,000 gays and lesbians who were discharged because of homosexuality since World War II. And every one of them have a story and a repercussion of what their discharge meant. You just don't want that to happen again. But I also think that there is the difference between those that are sort of advocates. That's their full-time job is gay advocacy, and that we're here, and you need them. But you also need your day-to-day soldiers doing their day-to-day jobs, which is why, I'm a nurse. I don't consider myself an activist. That sort of is what happens because of the position that I ended up getting put into and I feel responsible for. And that if someone feels that I can contribute something, then I continue to do that and take that as a responsibility. In regards to coping, my spouse, my now spouse, and we've been together almost 36 years, has been there for me the whole time, as have my kids. And so with their support, it's how you survive, because it is two separate lives. It's outside the home and then inside the home. And she's been there through all of it.
So with your advocacy, it's funny. It was best put to me with, all of us in the community, we all have our day job and our gay job. So we have what we do to make the bills, and then there's what we do for the community in our other time, because we feel that compellingness to, stand up and make sure that we're continuing to advocate for our community and for, because there are, we haven't been so far removed from the times when, the paperwork's still in a lot of files. So when looking at, what kind of advocacy work, recently I saw you speak, and one of the things you said that really stood out to me was when you said, if you're uncomfortable, you're probably in the right spot. What's making you uncomfortable right now, and what are you fighting for?
I'm old.
Right.
Yeah. It's also being in the right place for what it is that you're doing. And, at my age, it is now working for the community and in the community for aging issues. And how is it that we can take care of one another? I just went to Mexico to look at nursing homes down there. I mean, really taking on something new. I think what you end up doing is you look for meaning in what you do. And when, I think this is a backwards way to getting to your comment, but, when Don't Ask, Don't Tell was overturned, there was this elation for all of us who were involved in it. But then there was also this deflation of, well, now what do I do with my life? And then it just happened that the Defense of Marriage Act was still an issue. And so that became something that one could fight for, and then to repeal. And it was necessary because in the military you can't have two standards. You have to be able to support your partner and that sort of thing. So then that became an issue. And here in the state of Washington, we're also pretty progressive. And so we are frequently one step ahead. And so, you just, I think, find what relates to you, what you might be able to speak to in some way. And because I'm a nurse, because I had an adult family home, because I did this and because I did that, I really care about how we age in a safe, affordable way. And so that's where my focus has been now as much as anything else.
I love it. So you're still keeping busy.
Yeah.
Well, we could continue this conversation. I have about a million more things I wanted to ask you, but we'll save those conversations for another time. I want to thank you for your service. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your courage and your family's as well, for being willing to come out, share your story, to be vulnerable, to not take the easy answers, to get uncomfortable, and to fight for what you did. because we have careers and we're here, and there are soldiers that have come before us that are, you know, where they are because of the work you did. So we thank you so much for that. Additionally, thank you for agreeing to do this interview. It's so important to us that we don't lose this part of the Washington Guard's history and this part of our military history, so that we don't get in a position where, oh, everything's fine, we don't have to fight the fights anymore, because we do still. You know, we need to remember who we are, we need to remember what we're fighting for, and we need to remember our history and what brought us there. So thank you for
thank you.
My pleasure.